This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar.
And I'm Jeff Patak, Chief Ratings Officer for Morningstar Research Services.
Our guest this week is John Rogers, Jr. John is Chairman, Co-CEO, and Chief Investment Officer of Ariel Investments, the firm he founded in 1983. John is the lead portfolio manager of the Ariel Fund and also co-manages other Ariel strategies, including Ariel Small Cap Value, Small Mid-Cap Value, Mid-Cap Value, as well as Ariel Appreciation. John sits on several corporate boards, including the board of directors of McDonald's, Nike, and the New York Times, and serves as vice chair of the University of Chicago's Board of Trustees. In 2008, John was given Princeton University's highest honor, the Woodrow Wilson Award, for his work in civic and philanthropic circles. John received his bachelor's degree from Princeton. John, welcome to The Long View.
It's great to be here. It's a great name for this.
Well, thank you. We try to go in depth with our guests. We wanted to start by talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. We've seen a huge move toward DEI issues by fund companies. When they ask you as a pioneer in this area what they should do to promote best practices around DEI, what do you say?
I tell them that there's several things they can do, but the number one thing is you have to have a senior diverse talent within your organization if you really want to move the needle. I've seen this throughout my corporate life. If you have one or two or three people at the top of the organization that are African-American, Latino, dynamic women, they become Pied Pipers for talent because people see them as role models. People want to go and work in an organization where there are senior diverse people in these leadership roles, and that makes all the difference. And then when you have people in senior roles, they're there to be mentors and role models for the next generation of employees and can actually help keep talent in place. Because as you know, a lot of financial institutions, they hire their first diverse folks, people come in and they leave. But when you have those senior people, they can be there to answer tough questions, help people and guide them through whatever the culture is of the organization they're involved in. So first and foremost, you need to have the top of the house diverse. And also that top person or two should also be someone who's well-respected within the diversity community. Someone who's shown that they've been willing to fight for economic justice and fairness, really be willing to talk about these uncomfortable issues and have credibility within the minority community. That is so helpful also.
Black Americans are still underrepresented in the fund business. When other leaders ask for your advice on what steps they should take to change that and make their firms a more diverse, inclusive place, what do you tell them is most important to do and most important to avoid doing? I know that you just gave an example, diverse leadership is an important thing for them to do. Maybe there's another example of something that they should affirmatively do, and then maybe an example of something they should avoid.
I think a couple of things that they should do, and it's, I had the good fortune during the Obama administration to chair his financial council on financial capability for young Americans. It was basically about financial literacy. Chuck Schwab had chaired the similar committee during the Bush administration. And it was a great opportunity for me to be able to see all the different people thinking about financial literacy in different types of ways. So one of the things that I start with is what we've tried to do at Ariel. We created a small public school 25 years ago when Arne Duncan, former Secretary of Education, worked at Ariel and was overseeing all of our philanthropy. And at the Ariel Community Academy, we teach kids about the stock market. We give them real money to invest in real stocks. And the cool thing is not only the kids become more adept at investing and understanding how to do research on companies, but many of them have chosen to get started in financial services careers. It's really quite fun to see that. And actually, one young man, Miles Gage, he's being featured in a NASDAQ commercial about his digital app on helping educate young people about investing. And it's called Rapunzel. So it's sort of nice to see these young people grow up and start financial services careers because they got exposed to it while they were actually in grade school. So my number one suggestion is all financial services companies should partner with urban public schools within their local communities to get young people exposed to the markets. I just think that can, you know, build a next generation of great investors. I know Joe Mansueto's actually visited the Aerial Community Academy and was kind enough to talk to the kids in the investment class one morning. I'll never forget that. You know, when he drove up and, you know, jumped out and came and talked with our young people. So that's one thing that I think is important. The second thing we've done is we've worked really hard to build relationship with our local universities, and particularly the University of Chicago. I was fortunate to go to the University of Chicago Lab School. We've created a program there for minority students to get paid internships to work in the investment offices of major endowments. And just in the last 4 years, we've had over 64 kids go through the program. And again, a lot of the kids, when you work in an investment office of an endowment, you learn all about private equity and hedge funds and, you know, all the different asset classes. And it's starting to get people thinking about careers that they never could have dreamed of before they got involved in the program. So I think that's important. Work with your local university to build relationships with them and let the local universities in your community know that you're intentional about hiring young, dynamic people and diverse talent. And then they'll start to send you people. Once they know there's a local institution that cares, they'll start to send talent your way. And that's what's happened to us, and it's just worked out very well. And many of those kids finally have joined our internship program. And we've had superstars come through our internship program. Melody Hobson started out as a summer intern at Aerial. And the two top African-Americans at Northern Trust Bank, Shundron Thomas and Jason Tyler, got their career started at Aerial as summer interns. So I think internship programs are very, very important also.
For all the positive change that's taking place, the reality is that some of it is artifice. So given this, what should investors do to try to tell who is really mobilizing around DEI and who's simply going through the motions?
Well, I think you have to look at the leadership role. You'll see who's really hiring people that are change agents, that are out there in the community talking about these important issues and making a difference. So I think that's one way. You'll see whether, you know, these leaders are joining their local urban leagues, their NAACPs, local organizations that care about economic justice and fairness. That's one way to see it. The other way to see it, does the institution work with minority-owned businesses? I think all the time that if you really are about building a pipeline of talent and diverse talent, part of it is making sure you're supporting minority-owned companies at the same time. Now, that might be self-serving for us to say that, but I mentioned several people at our firm who've been superstars in the industry, but there are many, many more that I haven't mentioned who started at Aerial as full-time employees or interns that are now running their own private equity firms, their own long-only firms. They're working as financial advisors or investment bankers throughout the nation. And if we didn't exist and weren't there as role models, a lot of these young people would have never thought about financial services careers. So I think if you really care and you want to show you care about this, you know, working with minority-owned businesses, working with minority-owned financial services companies, having minority-owned funds in your 401k plan is a very visible symbol that you get it and you're working to make a difference.
You mentioned Chuck Schwab earlier. It looks like Aerial and Schwab had been partnering on surveying that you do. The results of the 2020 Aerial Schwab Black Investor Survey were recently released. It found that while there's been notable progress in stock market participation by younger Black Americans, that doesn't hold for previous generations, which lagged their white counterparts on a bunch of different measures, including stock ownership, retirement plan participation, savings, inherited wealth, and more. My question is, what can be done to close these gaps and achieve parity?
Oh, gosh, there's a lot that has to be done. You know, I start with this idea again that we've got to get financial institutions to partner with urban public schools to teach kids about the investing, teach them about compound interest, expose them to Warren Buffett and the great, you know, entrepreneurs who've built wonderful businesses around the stock market and help people understand how wealth can grow that way. The reason I start with that and continue to pound that point home is, as we know, you know, African-American communities, we don't have the wealth. And so, therefore, we haven't been as exposed to the financial markets. You need to learn about financial advice when you have something to invest. But because of the way that we came to this country and the historic discrimination, you know, African-American families haven't had a chance to create that kind of multi-generational wealth where you're going to need a financial advisor. And we don't often have aunts and uncles and grandparents teaching us about the stock market at the dinner table. because of the discrimination they faced a generation or two ago. They didn't have a chance to learn about the markets and get exposed to it. So I just keep coming back to, we got to get our public schools to do their work, but they're going to need help from local financial institutions if we really want to move the needle in this area. I also think that as you're thinking about this, as I've already talked about the programs that are so critically vital, you know, the internship programs, but I do think that you've got to make sure that within your own organization that you're bringing in people and helping them be successful. So what I mean by that is often, you know, financial advisors, the way you're successful, you have to be able to generate customers, right? You know, I was a financial advisor at William Blair when I started my career. And I realized back then that I didn't have the network and the access to wealthy families to be able to grow my business. And it was part of the reason I left to go into the money management business, where I didn't have to worry as much about that. But I think that what I ask people to do is to be part of a positive ecosystem. Whatever you're hiring, whether you're hiring a law firm or accounting firm or an investment bank, whatever professional service firm you're hiring, make sure they have diverse talent on your relationship. And if everyone does that, there'll be more opportunities for minorities in professional services to generate wealth because customers are demanding diverse teams on their relationships.
We want to switch over to talk about ESG, environmental, social, governance, investing. One of your strongest influences, Warren Buffett, has been a proponent of keeping non-financial goals separate from financial objectives. For instance, while Buffett has committed to philanthropy, personally, Berkshire itself doesn't engage in it, reflecting his view that the two ought to be separate and distinct. Yet we've seen a big push to combine the two, ESG being the banner under which it's increasingly done. Why not keep the two separate, like Buffett advises?
Well, we think it's not in the shareholders' best interest to keep these things separated. As we've talked to our mutual fund board about how we've been more intentional around ESG and have built up our ESG team, we have made it clear to them that we think by embracing ESG, we're ultimately going to have more profitable portfolios and more profitable companies within our Aerial Fund family that will enhance the performance of our Aerial Funds. And the reason that's the case is because if you think about it, in this modern day, as ESG has become more and more important, companies that are going to grow in the 21st century realize the customers care deeply about ESG. You know, I'm on the board of Nike, and they understand that next generation customers want to make sure that they're thinking about how those products are being manufactured and are all of the things being done in a way that supports the environment throughout the world. It's really important to customers. It's also really important to the up and coming employees. And, you know, at McDonald's, where I'm fortunate to be on the board, they know that if they're not taking ESG seriously, they will lose credibility with their young employee base and you won't be able to attract the most dynamic talent. And then finally, of course, shareholders care more about this than ever, and government leaders care more about this. So you can actually, we think, pretty clearly enhance the brand reputation of your company as a 21st century company if you embrace ESG. You'll be able to, again, please your customers, please your employees, the regulators and political leaders that oversee you, and your shareholders will all be happier with you, and therefore, your brand will be stronger, your cash flows will be stronger, and the profitability of those companies will be stronger.
I wanted to shift gears, widen out a bit, and talk about the market outlook. We recently spoke to noted author and advisor William Bernstein. Like you, he's a value investor. We asked him if he thought the stock market looks like a bubble, and he basically said he thought it did. Does this market remind you of the tech bubble like it reminds him? And if so, what's different about your approach in the current environment versus another in which valuations aren't as lofty?
This is reminding us of the internet bubble crazy time that we all lived through. There are so many companies selling for valuations that just don't make any sense. And there's no way that it could end up well for these hot tech companies, these new companies coming public with no profits. Those always end badly. The thing that's so important as a value investor is to stick to your discipline, you know, not get sucked into buying those really expensive high-flying stocks that have helped to goose the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ and the Russell indexes, and stay true to your true character. And so that's what we've been doing, the same, going back to the same playbook, buying the undervalued securities. They're still selling at significant discounts to private market value, low multiples to EBITDA, and you know, low PE ratios, looking for true bargains, and they're still out there. And we think the disconnect's going to happen, just like what happened with the internet bubble, as the tech and the S&P does very, very poorly. The value indices will have a really great period here of outperformance, because we've suffered for a long 12 years, but the valuations really still make sense for value securities, and we think they're poised to continue to outperform as we move throughout 2021.
You've argued that rising interest rates should boost value investing. Perhaps we're seeing a little bit of that right now. To start with, can you explain why?
Well, higher interest rates will help value managers for a couple of reasons. Higher interest rates will be caused by a very, very strong economy. You know, we think we're coming into a roaring 20s type of economy where a lot of the traditional manufacturers are going to be booming, the auto manufacturers, the metal building companies that are often in the Midwest. They're going to, again, have a really great, great period, a real tailwind behind them. And those are the kind of companies that have been relatively cheap relative to historic basis. And so the fast growing cash flows of the next 3 to 4 years, even if interest rates go up, these stocks are going to do really, really well because they've been left for dead for so long. On the other hand, the hot growth stocks that have been selling at these extraordinary multiples, you know, sometimes 30 and 40 times revenues, companies selling at 100 times earnings, the only way you can justify that is that if interest rates are really, really low and you do your discounted cash flow analysis and you really look at those future earnings and discount it back to today, with rates extraordinarily low, you know, you can make a case that these stocks deserve to be at high, high multiples. But as interest rates go higher and you discount those future cash flows, it's going to have an enormous impact on the underlying value of the companies and the true value and net worth of those businesses. So it's something that we really think it's so important when you do that basic, you know, analysis and just look at the cash flows expected for the future and then you discount it back based upon interest rates. Higher rates are going to have a much more negative impact on growth stocks at high multiples than traditional value stocks at low multiples.
Theoretically, that makes sense. I guess my question is, does history bear this out? Value investing has really only become, you know, truly more popular and widespread in the last 30 years or so, during which time we've seen rates steadily fall. So the question is, has the relationship truly been tested, in your opinion, based on your examination of market history?
You're right. In this period, it hasn't been tested. You know, I came of age of like a lot of investors during the period where we had such extraordinary high interest rates in the 80s. And you could have never imagined that you would have this complete steady downturn. But what gives me confidence is I talk to some of the, you know, respected people that I've gotten to know in the industry. You know, I've been very fortunate. When I was at Princeton, Bert Malkiel was the head of the economics department, and he had just written A Random Walk Down Wall Street. And we had to read that for corporate finance. And, you know, I've stayed in touch with Professor Malkiel. And he talks about how this is going to impact the stock market, these higher rates. I've had a couple of conversations with him and his fears. Similarly, Robert Alaber, one of the world-class international economists from the University of Chicago, has a similar opinion that this environment is going to be highly inflationary. It's going to cause higher rates. And we think those academic leaders really make sense with their arguments. And then finally, on the board of Ariel Investments, we have two top academic leaders, Martin Kramers, who's the head of the Notre Dame Business School and helped create the term active share, and Heather Tooks, who's an outstanding economist at Yale's Business School. They've also helped reinforce this view and this perspective from an academic standpoint. You know, this is just common sense. The high rates are going to be very, very negatively impactful for high-priced growth stocks. It's just the way the math works. And you just can't be emotional about it. It's just the way the math works.
What is the multi-year slump in small cap and value taught you that you didn't know entering this period?
I don't think that it's actually, you know, taught me anything that I didn't know already. You know, 38 years at Ariel has taught me that, you know, you have to be a long-term investor, number one. You have to, you know, not get swept up in the short term, and that market psychology can just take hold for a while and last much longer than you could ever possibly imagine. But eventually things get back to normal if you're just patient. And so these things happen. You know, people are going to chase what worked yesterday. People get enthusiastic about what worked yesterday. They just follow the crowd. It can make it uncomfortable for a long time when stock prices sort of disconnect from reality and real cash flows. But eventually things come back. You know, businesses are only going to be worth the discounted present value of their future cash flows. And it's going to get back to normal. And this disconnect was the largest gap between value and growth we've ever seen. So that just meant that when it came back, it was going to come back with a vengeance. And that's what we've been seeing the last 6 months or so.
I'm curious, you mentioned inflation earlier. I think that you were citing one of the experts that advises you, and that person seemed to indicate that they were expecting inflation to return with a vengeance. Just curious whether you concur with that view, and to the extent that you do agree, how that's expressing itself in the portfolios that you manage?
Well, first, I think that you know, there's no free lunch. As we all know, there's been an enormous amount of stimulus put into the economy over the last two financial crises. We know that, you know, just recently, you know, we had another huge stimulus package. And again, you just cannot keep printing money and feel there's no negative consequences. The world doesn't work that way. And all the logic is if you print more and more money, it's not going to be worth as much. And you have all this extraordinary supply. So we think that inflation is just the natural follow through from all the overspending. I shouldn't say overspending. It was necessary spending during the pandemic. We needed to prop up the economy. We had to get people the dollars they needed to live on. It was the right thing to do. But down the road, we have to pay the piper. And that's going to come from higher inflation.
Can you talk about how the competitive dynamics have changed for investors like you who favor the stocks of inexpensive small companies that boast at least some competitive advantage? The question is, are these firms as plentiful as they were before, given that firms are staying private longer amid a glut of liquidity in private markets?
I think you're right in theory. You know, over the 38 years at Ariel, the universe has shrunk. And no doubt about it, so many mergers, you know, companies trying to bulk up to be competitive, to keep their competitive advantage, to keep their moat. And so many of the industries we've invested in, where you had six or seven companies, now you're down to two or three companies in those sectors that you kind of know really, really well. And then the challenges that happened in the economy and all the private equity money that's out there and people can stay private longer, all those things have had an impact. But I do think that's starting to shift some now. I do think that with more and more IPOs coming out, as the markets have been so strong, the explosion of SPACs, I think you're going to see a larger universe of companies over the intermediate term for people like us to invest in. So in general, you're right. It is a smaller universe, but I think that universe will be getting larger and larger over the intermediate term. But we also feel like because small value has been out of favor for so long, the publicly traded companies that are out there are relatively cheap. And just watching the disconnect between the NASDAQ and the Russell 2000 Growth Index and then the small value indexes has just been so dramatic that there are still bargains, even though the universe might be smaller. It just means you have to have the courage of your convictions to buy things that are being neglected, misunderstood, that have been left out of the indexes or not major parts of the indexes. Stocks are not always trading based on fundamentals these days.
Maybe if we could talk about business quality itself, do you think business quality is as lasting as it used to be? On the one hand, we can find examples of dominant firms that have gotten even stronger, given things like network effects and lighter touch approach to regulation. On the other hand, we've seen technology upend a number of business models once thought to be durable. So if moats don't last as long, has that impacted the way you run money?
I think your question is right on. We spend an inordinate amount of our time and we have, you know, two meetings a week with our portfolio management team and with our analyst. And a good bit of that time is trying to figure out how sustainable the moat is. You know, those are all of our questions. I shouldn't say all of our questions, but a good majority of the questions are trying to test the hypothesis over and over again. To your point, are there changes in this technological revolution that's going to impact our moats? Is it because of all the M&A out there, the companies that are left that are smaller are not going to be able to maintain their moats? just certain industries are changing and evolving just in general, where their products are not as relevant anymore, and new competitors have been able to figure out ways to come in and make a difference. So the job is harder and the pain is greater if you're wrong. If you're wrong on guessing and doing your research and looking into the future about the strength of the moat, we talk about this all the time. It can catch up to you so fast that what you thought you had some time to figure out, whether the new world was going to really impact your moat, it just, boom, it happens so rapidly. The moat disappears overnight and your company is all of a sudden half of the price it was before. So it just means the rigor of your research is more important than ever. The relationships with management teams is more important than ever. Having experienced analysts and portfolio managers who, you know where to focus is key. Because otherwise, you're exactly right. The damage that can be done to your portfolio is so dramatic these days if you get it wrong.
You're the rare fund manager who owns the shares of other publicly traded asset and wealth managers. Janus Henderson, AMG, Northern Trust, and Lazard are all examples. Some of these are longtime holdings that you've stuck with. What's the outlook for the money management industry in your view?
I think the outlook for the money management industry is actually looking up. We've been adding over the last 6 months to all those positions. Some got particularly cheap, really out of Lazard and AMG, for example, just got crushed during the pandemic period and the stock prices just didn't make sense. So for us, we think that because this has been a hated group, there's bargains within this industry. You're starting to see some smart investors moving in, people looking at ways to figure out through M&A and other strategic things that can be done to make sure the companies can be successful in this next part of the economy. And the other part that I think is really critically important is that, you know, we think that as the S&P struggles in this new environment, that active management is going to become popular again. And people start to realize that if you just buy the S&P 500 that owns all the big FANG stocks and Microsoft, you know, Tesla, et cetera, you know, it's like a handful of stocks are going to have so much impact on the S&P 500. And those stocks are so extraordinarily expensive and overvalued. It's inevitable that the S&P is going to suffer when those stocks correct. So I think a lot of smart advisors are realizing it's time to look to active managers that don't have their portfolios, you know, chock-a-block with those stocks that boomed over the last 5 years that are going to have a much tougher time over the next 5 years. So that'll be a great tailwind for active managers.
I wanted to shift gears and talk stocks, specifically selling and buying for a few minutes, maybe starting with Viacom, which is a name you've owned in Aerial Fund, if I'm not mistaken, for some time. It's soared since last spring, rising nearly 700% off its early April lows, which seems to reflect a brightening ad and content licensing outlook. Now it looks more expensive. Can you reflect on what lessons situations like these, a story that's worked out a nice business but pricey, have taught you through the years about how and when to sell?
Well, let's start with the beginning, though, like when to buy, because you know, in the 38 years at Aerial, you know, we're really, really proud of the long-term performance, as well as the 1 year, 3 year, 5 years, and 10 years. I think there's, you know, not many funds that have the same portfolio manager. You know, Aerial Fund is actually now 35 years old this year. And so one of the things we've learned that our outperformance, a lot of it has been tied to our ability to buy our favorite stocks during times of panic, times of dislocation, uncomfortable times. And where we've lived, you know, Warren Buffett's mantra to be greedy when others are fearful, Sir John Templeton's view, you want to buy when there's maximum pessimism. So sometimes you'll have a favorite stock, it's getting crushed in a really bad market, it completely collapses as the markets collapse, and many people give up, sell at the bottom, or many people sit on their hands and wait till the dust settles. What we do is we double down on our favorite names where we know them well, and they're in our circle of competence, and you can buy a wonderful company, you know, at an extraordinary discount to its underlying value. So that's what's happened with Viacom CBS. It never should have sold at $11 a share, and it was just really inexpensive. Now the stock closed today around 96, you know, 97. It's been an extraordinary home run this last year, and we have been steadily lightening up the position because, you know, we have to be true to our value criteria. If you're going to load up when things are really bargain priced, as they get relatively expensive, it's time for us to be lightening up. You know, the business is doing really, really well, but also the reason why it's doing really terrifically well is they are making the move into streaming very effective with their Paramount Plus brand and the ability to have news like 60 Minutes and nightly news and morning news along with all the content of Paramount, and at the same time have live sports and all the great entertainment things from the Emmys to the Oscars, et cetera. They really have one of the best packages. So the stock is really selling now instead of on traditional multiples. It's really more on the streaming multiples. People look to the future and value those companies that have great content that can be streamed, sell at much, much higher multiples. So we still like it. We think Bob Backus has done a great job as CEO, but we wouldn't be doing our job as value managers if we weren't significantly lightening up consistently during this environment.
You touched on this briefly in your last answer, but I'd like to talk about the flip side, names where you've seen the fundamentals deteriorate and the price fall. That played out most vividly last spring with some of your holdings losing half of their value in just a few weeks. What are the progressions that you'll go through with an analyst in assessing whether the thesis behind a stock is bent but not broken? Maybe you can talk about that in the context of a specific holding or two.
Depending if you're looking at a brand new name or an existing holding, but you're right. Some of our favorite stocks in the portfolio really cratered during that period. And we mentioned Viacom, CBS being one that was one of our most, you know, sort of gut-wrenching experiences. There were actually several ones to pick from that, you know, for us just did not make sense at all. So a couple that were relatively long-term holdings that I like to talk about, Mattel was one that really got hurt badly. Another one was Nielsen, you know, again, extraordinary brand, got crushed. And what we do with our analytical team is we always, when the stock's getting hit like that, if first if they announce earnings disappointments, we take a deep breath. We've learned through behavioral finance work that we do that often analysts are anchored in old numbers and take a long time to get reality calibrated with their earnings estimates. So we're going to just take a breath, be patient. You know, 20 years ago, we would have been buying more of the stock the first day it cratered on bad earnings. Now we're patient in taking this time to relook at our entire thesis. You know, get on the phone with management teams. We think we get great access to management because we have our reputation of being long-term contrary investors. People like having us as shareholders. So we get on the phone with management teams, as you would expect. All of us senior portfolio managers are on the calls together. You know, all of the senior guys and Serena and our team have been together through the last financial crisis. So we don't like to just have the analysts doing the work. We, as the older teammates, want to get involved and engaged in doing the research too and evaluating the management team under pressure, seeing how they respond to questions, seeing how honest and direct that they are. And we think you need some grizzled veterans to be on that team. You also, at the same time, you're going to, of course, be talking to competitors, you know, talking to board members, talking to former employees, and equally important, talking to other value managers who you respect, who've either been buying a favorite name like Mattel or are finding reason to sell it. We're looking at someone who owns Nielsen. So, example, our friends at Southeastern Management, we actually doubled up on a couple of names. You know, they were big owners in Mattel. They were big owners in AMG that also got crushed. And it's good to talk to Staley Cates and see how they're dealing with it. Folks in the Capital Group who own some of our favorite names, you know, you talk to them, but that's just many. You talk to Mario Gabelli, you talk to Tom Russo, you talk to retired veterans like Ralph Wenger of the Acorn Funds. You want to get as many perspectives on a troubled company and a troubled industry as possible. And as I say, our own analysts are just part of the mosaic of that homework. You just can't depend on your own internal people. You've got to reach out. And of course, you're going to talk to sell side analysts and the ones you think that know the industry the best surround that company. As we're doing all that homework, you know, sometimes we learn something that we maybe should have known before and decide to sell or scale out of a position. But more often than not, as time passes and you get a little bit away from that earnings disappointment, we'll start to rebuild the position and take advantage of the bargain prices to buy for the long run. You know, it's funny. I was talking to Sir John Templeton's niece the other day, who's a terrific investor, and she was talking about how her uncle always talked about the fact that the bargains he was snapping up in the crash of 1987 were going to give him years of good performance as he moved into the end of that decade and into the early 90s. And that happened with us. you know, and it happened with us in 87, it happened with us in 2008 and 2009, and it's happened again this time. These are these chances that are painful to go through, but it's so exciting to buy wonderful companies at these bargain prices. And then to find new, fresh ideas that you didn't own that are all of a sudden quite cheap.
I wanted to shift gears and talk about how you manage the firm. You made Melody Hobson, who you mentioned earlier, your co-CEO, about 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. Melody's abundant talents aside, can you talk about what prompted that move from a broader organizational perspective and update us on how the sharing of duties has worked out in practice?
I'll start with that. It's beat all expectations. We've been very, very excited about this. And Melody says she's part of now building Ariel 2.0 and you know, just making sure that she's taking the best of what we've built over 38 years and then looking for ways to make improvements. She's just so energized. It's just been exciting. So it's gone extraordinarily well. Our board of directors is thrilled. Internally, we're all thrilled. It's just been a really good decision. A couple things led up to the decision. I think that there was a sense that, you know, I'm 62. I hope to do this, you know, at least till Ariel Fund is 50 years old. So I have hopefully a long runway, but we thought it was important for people to know that we had a firm succession plan in place. And that was crystal clear. The second thing we wanted to clear up was that Melody had been, in effect, operating as co-CEO the last several years. You know, she had been taking on more and more responsibility, leaving me to just focus on investing, picking stocks, researching companies, you know, visiting companies. And so we wanted there to be real truth in labeling where people really understood that outside of the stock picking, Melody was making all the other decisions. And we thought that was important for everyone internally to know that. And equally importantly, all of our customers and external constituencies to understand where the real decision making was. And this ability to focus just on investing has been a real blessing of our partnership that's developed over the last 30 years that Melody's been at Ariel. And it's just, it's been more and more crystallized. And then the final thing is, you know, a lot of people know Melody's been such a history maker, you know, and such a leader. You know, just yesterday, you know, she officially took over as the chairman of Starbucks, you know, the only African-American woman in the country, chair of a major Fortune 500 company. It's an amazing accomplishment. I think there were some people out there, maybe with sexist attitudes, who felt that Melody's been so successful, she's not going to want to, you know, work at Ariel for the long term. So by her becoming co-CEO, it was a very visible way to say that this was her baby too, and that she was going to build her career and continue to build her career at Ariel. And, you know, we worked with her on having her become the major shareholder in the company, and with me as the number two shareholder, which also signaled to everyone that, you know, Melody was going to be around for the long term to build Ariel into this Ariel 2.0, as she calls it. So all those are the reasons we did this, and it's just worked out beautifully.
You mentioned that you and Melody divide and conquer in many ways. How about the chief investment officer responsibilities that are now yours? What is the succession plan there?
Well, the succession plan there is we have a couple of up-and-coming leaders that have both been with us quite a long time. Tim Feidler, our director of research, has been with the firm now over 20 years. And if I got hit by the proverbial bus today, he would take over as, you know, the chief investment officer. We also this last year promoted Ken Kurt, who has been with the firm roughly 17 years, a terrific younger portfolio manager analyst. He's been trained by Tim beautifully. He understands our contrarian investment strategy. He's the kind of guy who comes in during the financial crisis saying, you know, we need to buy one spa that does the spa services on cruise ships. You know, who comes in and wants to buy spa services and cruise ships in the middle of a pandemic? But it's been a great stock. And so his leadership has been extraordinary. So Tim and Ken are the folks that are the heir apparents to take over leadership as a, you know, chief investment officer for the company. And that's been great. And then Charlie Bobrinskoy continues to be vice chairman and key at all of our thought leadership at the firm, which we think is critically important. He leads all of our behavioral finance work. He took us through a whole survey today with our research team on the Adam Grant's new book, Think Again, you know, which is a really great book for analysts because it teaches you how to get new information and think about it in a new way. So, you know, Charlie provides an enormous amount of leadership and will continue to do that if I get hit by that bus.
You serve, and you alluded to this earlier, you serve on a number of corporate boards. What has that experience taught you about collaboration and group decision-making, and how have you applied that at Ariel?
Well, I would say every situation has been different, and this is hard to say a simple answer because it's been so much of an important part of, I think, what is one of our distinguishing characteristics at Ariel. So I would just say first on the part of your question, like I was on the Bank One board when Jamie Dimon came in and became the CEO. And to watch him come in and replace, I think it was literally 15 out of the top 16 officers, fixate on technology and how he could get all of the legacy banks to talk with each other and, you know, be 21st century companies. It was just interesting to see how his team played, how he surrounded himself with these dynamic, strong, independent, free-thinking executives, people who've gone on to run large companies like Charlie Scharf, and you know, I could go on and on of people who've left, you know, Jamie's leadership to be CEOs of major companies. So I watched the way he built management teams, worked with those management teams, led those management teams, and learned a lot about leadership watching Jamie do that. I was on the Aon board for 18 years, and I watched Pat Ryan, you know, surround himself with the strongest board members he could possibly find. You know, he got people who were real outspoken leaders, people who've been CEOs of major companies from, you know, McDonald's to Standard Oil, you know, just people who were going to help make him better, press him to be better, push him to be the best. So it's something I've learned there that I want to make sure that not only do we have a strong management team that's strong and independent, but you want a strong independent board of directors. And we would argue our mutual fund board is the most strongest, most independent mutual fund board in the country. And it's part of Pat Ryan's legacy. Other thing I learned from Pat and Andy McKenna, who's the lead director there, they do a great job of keeping all of their directors in the loop on all the important issues they need to know and what's coming down the pike and preparing them for the next board meetings. I think that's vitally important from a leadership and governance standpoint. You know, it helps me with my ESG work when it gets to the governance aspect. And then the final thing I would say is that I think I'm a better professional services analyst because of my 18 years at Aon. You know, I can look at real estate services as well as insurance brokerage and other, you know, companies that are commission-based and have a better feel for them because of the experience I had on the inside of a place like Aon that was built into a worldwide brand in professional services. I know I'm a better banking analyst because of my years on the Bank One board and the First Chicago MBD board, the American National Bank board, that they all spun into each other. But, you know, learning how those banks worked, the challenges that they faced, helps me when I'm evaluating a bank today, even though I've been off the board for, I don't know, 10 years. It makes you a better analyst because you are there. And then finally, I should say, whether it's being on a corporate board or being on a board like the University of Chicago, you're around really smart people who've done amazing things in their career. And to be able to pick their brains on how they've become successful, what they're seeing in the economy. I always believe you learn a lot when you surround yourself with really smart, thoughtful people who can, you know, push your game up because you feel competitive. You got to be up to speed and be on top of things and then be able to, again, call them on the phone during tough times in the economy and say, what are you thinking? What are you seeing? What is going on in your industry? It makes you better.
Looks like in a few of your board responsibilities and certainly in your equity holdings, you've had to oversee the transition from one leader to the next, with some of those changes involving an iconic CEO or members of a founding family. What lessons has that imparted that you've used or plan to use in ensuring that Ariel succeeds well into the future?
Well, I think that, you know, one thing is Andy McKenna, who is now 91 years old and, like chairman emeritus at McDonald's, he always said years ago when I was first on a board with him, the most important thing that a board does is to do the succession plan. And, you know, God forbid, I mean, you know, you don't want a crisis to happen, but you have to be ready for it. And, you know, at McDonald's, we had the heartbreaking situation where we lost two CEOs within a year of each other, one from a heart attack, I think, and the other one from cancer. It was just absolutely brutal. But we were prepared because, you know, Andy had taught us how important that was to think through who could be next up if something did happen tragically. So that's what we've tried to do at Ariel. Again, really focused. That's why we have this plan with Melody. I've had Melody in mind to be my successor for quite a long time, to have a deep team of people who are ready to take over, you know, create a climate where people know they can make their own decisions. They're not coming to me for decisions. I think that's something critical too, because people often ask, how do you get so much done in a week? You know, most of the reason is because I have great teammates who I trust to make decisions and lead us where we need to go. And I know you've been blessed by that with Joe Mansueto and the kind of leadership you've had at Morningstar, where you have someone who trusts his teammates. Those are the things that you have to do if you're going to build the kind of folks that can take over in a crisis and be prepared when the inevitable succession happens.
Well, John, this has been such a great conversation. We really appreciate you taking the time to share your insights.
Anytime. This is just so fun.
Well, thank you so much. And thanks for spending time with us today. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Long View from Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number 1.
George Cassidy is our engineer for the podcast, and Carrie Gretchick produces the show notes each week. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Patak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.